Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. My name is Michael Walker, and I'm here with my friend and co-host, Mark. How are you this week, Mark?
I'm very well. I'm recently repatriated back to Kingston. I visited Philadelphia and New Jersey. They were very much bordering the Delaware River.
I heard that they do that.
Yeah, I met some lovely people in Philadelphia. It was suggested by Dr. Contra that what happened is we acquire a kazoo and someone play the kazoo prior to my kicking down the door and saying, "Do you know who I am?" We thought that kazoo music would be the appropriate reference. Sadly, we could never find the kazoo, so this plan was never put into operation.
All right, first we're going to talk about the Eurus, the game we reviewed exactly a year ago, then the games we played this week, the news and why it doesn't matter, and the topic this week, which is small box, big game. Mark, we reviewed exactly 1 year ago a Reiner Knizia game called Through the Desert.
A modern classic. This was in honor of the all-play version being released after some crowdfunding, after it had been out of print for a little bit. But it was originally published by Cosmos in 1998 with pastel camels. Now the camels are a little less pastel, but they're still delightfully colored. We have constant arguments about which color is which. I maintain the sweet tart color scheme, where they're all flavors of sweet tart, with the exception of that odd, not quite green, not quite blue, not quite yellow coloration, which we call detergent, following a friend in Massachusetts.
And the new edition, all-play edition, came with some modules that we don't play with.
Nope, we do not.
And Through the Desert has been played multiple times because it's one of those five-player games that's easy to teach and easy to get to the table.
Very quick, very satisfying. We had a recent game of Through the Desert where the scores were extraordinarily small by virtue of the fact that everyone was loading in on the same color camel. Now, this is an element of variance because it is somewhat arbitrary, admittedly, which color is going to end up where. But it was a dynamic that was evident from the mid-game, and so we all got to scramble to accommodate for it. We immediately played again as a consequence, and scores were easily double what they had been before. It was very interesting to see those two back-to-back.
And that is the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Now on to the games we played this week. Mark, what did you play this week?
Got to play Pocket Paladin. This is a review copy sent to us by the designer Joe Klipfel. Joe Klipfel is the one who designed Behold Rome, as well as Gloomholden, as well as co-designed Gloomhaven Buttons and Bugs with Nikki Valens. And Joe Klipfel's design idiom is to take a small number of cards, typically the 18-card model that a lot of print and play and indie designers follow, And he really likes designing games where the entirety of the game is in your hand. So, for example, in Behold Rome, all you need is just one hand. That's it. You're moving cards around, but the entire game state is stored in one hand. Gloomholden did the same thing. Pocket Paladin abandons this particular conceit and instead seeks to replicate a sort of overland fantasy adventure experience where you've got skills that are leveling up. You can empower skills by using additional crystals. You're moving around on a hex-based map, fighting various monsters and seeking to conquer a city. In other words, it's just like Mage Knight. Normally, when we say this, it is what we call a joke. In this case, it is literal. It is very much like Mage Knight, deliberately and explicitly. So there's the elements of micronization, and then there's the gameplay itself. The elements of micronization are done extraordinarily well, I think. The entire package comes from the Game Crafter, and you can find it on the Game Crafter as part of their crowd sale model at the moment. And there are tiny little tokens, there are map cards, there are ability cards, there are level tracking cards. All of it fits inside a penny sleeve. The goal was to create something truly portable, and while you do need an actual surface, unlike some of other Joclipful games, it does indeed port extraordinarily well. It is more portable than my game of R, aka Brave Rats, which is basically 14 cards and 2 reference cards. And so the fact that it's more portable than that is quite frankly amazing. And you have almost all of the conventions of Mage Knight. You have allies, you have skills. As you level up, you might get one or the other. You have to recruit them. You go to towns, you do diplomatic actions, as well as do combat in the Overland. Here's my one big problem with Pocket Paladin. I really liked it as a design conceit, as a design challenge, as an iteration on a formula. I thought all of that was fascinating and very cool, and I enjoyed learning it. The problem was the actual play experience is something I did not enjoy, and here's why. The fundamental driving system of Mage Knight itself is a deck builder hand management type experience. You look at your hand, you figure, okay, what can I get done with this hand? And or I save this card for later. All right, fine. And there's a certain amount of mystery, and there's thus a certain amount of improvisation, reaction, you know, all that kind of stuff we talked about last week in the context of pulling levers, by virtue of when the cards fall into your hand as a response to various elements of the map. The way that it works in Pocket Paladin is you have this matrix of actions, this web of action nodes. At the start of the game, it starts at relatively low. As you gain levels, though, it starts to expand. And every node on this matrix is an action you can do, or a boosted corresponding action. So, for example, one node might say 2 move, but if you throw a crystal at it, suddenly it's 3 ranged attack. And there are 3 kinds of crystals. This time, keyed off of suits of playing cards rather than colors, as they were in Mage Knight. And there are arrows, sometimes bidirectional, sometimes unidirectional, from these various nodes. So, okay, I'm on this node, I did the 2 movement. Okay, from this node, I can move to these 2 other nodes. This one lets me do some attack, this one allows me to do some negotiation. Okay, and you're allowed to basically go along 3 lines. So you're moving your action tracker along this matrix, and you get to do 3 things on this matrix following lines. And this part is a very, very sparse, very demanding, very exacting efficiency puzzle. And that part I did not enjoy. It is the fundamental driver of the game, and so consequently you spend a lot of time staring at this card of interlinked actions, noticing that there are really only 2 places to get a solid chunk of movement, and that's always been one of the challenge of the Mage Knight formula. In Mage Knight and in Pocket Paladin as well, anytime you want to win a fight, first you need to go start the fight, and that usually involves some deployment of movement points. And so getting things set up, getting to the point where I could engage in a lot of movement and in a lot of combat required manipulating this matrix in a way that I found deeply counterintuitive and overall not to my taste. People who like more abstract, puzzly things might have a better time with the action selection mechanism, with the action delivery mechanism of Pocket Paladin. But as it was, I found it, especially in those early levels, very restrictive. And the sort of safety valve that Mage Knight has is burning cards sideways to generate 1 point of whatever. In the context of Pocket Paladin, you can still do that, but it only generates 1, and you're limited to 3 actions a turn rather than your starting 5-card hand in Mage Knight. And so consequently, there was much less room for error, which is understandable. It's a less complex system. It's a smaller universe of effects overall. And I didn't feel that the game lost anything in that translation. Except that. I missed the hand management. I missed the deck building element. And frankly, with a different action mechanism, I might have enjoyed Pocket Paladin much, much more. As it is, I found it a very interesting design experiment that was for the most part successful, except for the part where it didn't jive with how I like to play games. And so ultimately, I would very much made me want to go back to Behold Rome, so I'll probably be starting up another game of that. And I'm constantly in awe of Joe Kliffel's design chops. It's just in this particular case, it was not calibrated to my taste, and so I found the efficiency challenge unpleasant overall.
It's very hard to get that Mage Knight feeling, right? Because there are so many giant decks in Mage Knight. And there are, I'm sure there are lots of people that play it a lot. But for people like us who play it off and on, there's always those cards that either A, you've never seen or hardly ever see in either the spells or the allies. And it's that sense of, you know, revealing and wonder that you get to finally put them in your deck type thing.
Allies less so, but yeah, the advanced actions and the spells, you get it. You haven't seen it used much or at all, exactly. And you can build an amazing turn around them, and that is indeed part of the challenge of Mage Knight. In Pocket Paladin, again, you have allies, you have skills, and so that is an extra element of leveraging some of that magic of Mage Knight. But ultimately, the core driver, I just found too limiting and unpleasant to deal with. So unfortunately, I don't think I'll be going back to Pocket Paladin. But as I say, I love watching Joe Kliffel work. So this is Pocket Paladin by Joe Kliffel, Mythfield Games this year, available on GameCrafter.
We got to play Seven Empires by Matt Gertz. This is put out by Rio Grande, and it's finally available here in North America. And I found it was very similar to Imperial 2030, but just so much more streamlined. In Imperial 2030, it gives you this feeling that it's going to be sort of a Risk or Axe and Allies type game, because it has all these empires and they have troops and tanks, and you think you're going to control one of these empires and fight each other, and you really need to drive it home to the players that you're sort of, you know, these conglomerate masterminds puppeteering all of these things on the board, and you're just trying to get the most money out of it. And so what Seven Empires done is it's so streamlined, because in Imperial 2030 there was all these like weird rules about, okay, you can get some influence here, but it has to be just a certain kind of influence. You can't buy that because you're not going to win. And if you don't have an empire, I just remember there being some sort of rules to buying influence in 2030.
Only if you're flagless. Like, the strange rules, and you see these rules questions all the time on Board Game Geek, and I don't understand why they're so confused. Largely based on an optional rule called the Swiss Bank, which I don't think should have been included in the game to begin with, which was largely introduced to mollify players who didn't quite understand how the game worked anyway. Setting all that aside.
I just thought there was a three there, you already had a three, so you couldn't get that three. I thought there was just some weird purchasing rules. Anyway, now it's
buy whatever you want.
It's much easier now. You just pick a card and you add it to your tableau, and if it, you know, gets you the most, then, or even tied and you have a higher ranking, there's three ranks. You either have nobility, clergy, or bourgeois, A, B, and C, and whoever has, you know, the higher rank will win ties. Nice and straightforward, and Mike, like Mark's already said, no more Swiss silliness. It's just...
We love the Swiss here at Silver and Armored Games. Let me make that perfectly clear. I love your cheese.
Just so.
I'm a big fan of your cheese.
Because like I said, when it's your turn, you get to do an action with an empire you control.
My reverence for the cheese is almost so profound, it's holy.
But which ones you can control often go back and forth all the time. It's like, you know, Huey's bought some influence in Spain, and now it's more than mine, so he takes the crown token for Spain, and when it's his turn, now he can, you know, activate Spain, as long as it's not already activated again. Because unlike so many other Matt Gertz games, there's no rondel in this one. It's this interesting sort of conveyor belt system of action tokens. So if I do it like an attack action, then it goes into the queue and I have to wait till it moves off the queue so I can use it again. And each empire can only act once in a given turn. So if it's your turn and all the empires that you have control of have acted, then you have to look down your tableau and see which one is the highest next highest influence. And if they haven't acted, then you can. And if that isn't true, then one of the empires that haven't acted yet, that player gets to take your turn, but you get to add a free troop somewhere on the map. So this is very interesting, quick, you know, unlike 2030 was. And
was it quicker?
I think so.
So I looked down. It felt... It's weird because Imperial, both Imperial and 2030, can be 2.5 hours on occasion. With players who know what they're doing, or especially with a relatively smaller player count, it's closer to 2, and sometimes under 2. I played games of Imperial that were not particularly rushed that lasted about 90 minutes, but again, that was mostly for experts. It took us about 2 hours to play 7 Empires. Some of that was set up, but that's excluding rules explanation. So I'm not sure how much time efficiency we're gaining. Anyway, please continue.
The next very streamlined thing that brings it well and above Imperial 2030 is how to get points. It's just so much more streamlined and evident. You don't have to, you know, it's not this weird... I know you're going to correct me and say it's easy in 2030.
Weird. It's a little strange. It's very artificial and gamey.
Yeah.
You have this weird... In Imperial, you have this strange stepped system. And so you can end up in weird situations where a nation seems to give out more points or fewer points than is necessary. Because both Imperial and Seven Empires are basically stock games. You're getting stock levels of influence in these various empires. And how well those empires do will determine how many points you get. Conversely, in Seven Empires, it's a strict ranking system, and whichever empire is the most powerful disgorges more points, and then on down the line.
Yep. Nice and straightforward. Makes it easy to understand. You know, for the first game, we're all sort of, you know, wondering how it was all going to pan out in the end.
Mostly because the board state was so difficult to decipher, but that was largely for the good. Not knowing where the game is going to head is definitely to its advantage, because... One of the things that I couldn't help but notice in the context of Seven Wonders, it's impossible, frankly, to discuss Seven Wonders outside the context of Imperial for 2 reasons. Number 1, we have a great deal of affection for Imperial. And number 2, they're just frankly very similar. And they're similar in a way that lots of other board games don't do. Again, most games of this ilk, as you identified, are troops on a map game. Whereas Imperial and Seven Wonders are conflict games with a stock element where you win not by holding territory, but by having the biggest investments. And some of the very satisfying elements of Imperial are very much present in Seven Empires in exactly the same way. At the end of the game, one player controlled 3 different empires, and it seemed like they were dominating the entirety of the board state. But in point of fact, the player who won only ever really controlled 1 empire over the course of the game, and it wasn't even the empire they started with. And so that was very satisfying.
Yeah.
The part that I found less satisfying, though, was in some of the streamlining, I wonder, this is a wonder, because we're definitely going to go back to Seven Empires again. I personally think that Matt Gertz is one of the very, very best game designers working today. He's designed some of my favorite all-time games, like Imperial, like Antica. Navigador is brilliant. He's also designed Concordia, which is widely loved. It's not one of my favorite Matt Gertz games, but it's still really good. I adore his designs and his design work and his design philosophy. And all his games tend to be very, very approachable, rules light, but with interesting game states that move at an excellent pace. Seven Empires, though, by virtue of jettisoning an economic model, and now instead of buying stocks, you're literally just drafting cards with an influence value at various intervals over the course of the game, loses, I think it seems, a lot of the dynamism that makes Imperial so tense. Because when you draft a card from an empire, you start with all the best cards. And so in some cases, even before the game starts, all the best cards are out. They've already been taken. Or certainly after the first 2 drafts. Consequently, the ability to wrest control of an empire from someone else just diminishes, vanishes to almost nothing. There was a juncture about midway through the game where I thought I had a small chance of taking an empire back from someone who had taken it from me, but just vicissitudes of the turn order made it impossible. And there were no changes in control in the second half of the game. None. So you don't have those instances where you're looking around wondering, do they have enough cash to take it from me? I'm about to make a big, big move with this empire. But do they have the money? Are they going to have the chance? The time comes up. They have the money. They take it. And it's a huge swing. Now, this may strike you as a bad thing. But the dynamism of Imperial and Imperial 2030 is one of the reasons why I liked it so much. And one of the reasons why I was okay with the fact that it is reliably 2-ish hours, sometimes longer. Seven Empires, I felt most of the interesting stuff happened at the beginning in terms of ownership. And most of the interesting things in terms of actions happened later. Because any given empire can only do 1 of 3 actions at any given time. And at the start of the game, all of the 7 empires have the same 3 actions. So we saw a lot of duplication in terms of moves. It took the mid-game for the board state to be interesting. And it also took the mid-game for the ownership stakes to solidify. If this is true, those are bad augurs, I think. That's a bad combination. Did I enjoy my time with Seven Empires? A great deal. But again, part of this was just interest in watching a design evolve. And I think the system is clean. I think the scoring is cool. I really like, parenthetically, how it deals with asymmetry. Because there's this idea that Prussia is not expected to do as well as England, both historically and in terms of the way the board shakes out. And that was definitely our experience. The way this is balanced is the card values for Prussia are much higher. So if you spend your drafting action to take a stake in Prussia and it does well, you'll gain far more points with it than spending that same opportunity to invest in England or France or any of the other traditional empires that dominated the period. So that part I thought was really cool. And in conjunction with the sort of fog of not knowing how the game is going to shake out, there was a lot of interesting options for risk for investments to pan out. But maybe this is me expecting Seven Empires to be more like Imperial than it actually is. I don't know. I think I'm going to need more plays, both to let Seven Empires speak on its own terms and so that I can see if these initial observations are correct.
And back to the asymmetry part, because the pieces that you get for your military units are set. And they're actually different for the different empires. So I found that very interesting. Like, some have more infantry and more fleets than others. And I thought that was a very interesting twist.
It's extraordinarily well done. And it's very interesting. And when I say when I'm comparing it unfavorably to Imperial, keep in mind that Imperial is my fourth favorite game of all time. If I say that I prefer Imperial, that's not really much condemnation at all. And everyone at the table, myself included, was interested in trying it again. It's very flexible for player count, and I'm eager to see Seven Empires develop on its own terms.
And we played it with four.
Yes.
We can play it up to six.
Yes.
Do you think that will pan out the influence a little bit differently?
It's possible.
Because, all you know, more of the high values will go out, and so there might be a little more...
Yes, it's possible. I don't know. But it might, again, just emphasize that the changes in control will be at the early game and then probably not again. So, you know, if I start controlling the game with a six, but the seven's available for draft, somebody drafts the seven, it's like, well, maybe we'll just pass it back and forth between the two of us, but in so doing, we would forego any investment anywhere else. Maybe we'll just ossify under different conditions. I don't know. Like I say, I'm curious.
And the actions are definitely work, baby, first Seven Empire steps. It's always set with those three. You don't mix it up.
Correct.
For your second game.
Correct. Right. The initial setup. There are variants for changing up the initial setup in terms of what cards people start with. And it didn't look like that would address my key concerns, although it might be worth investigating. But as far as the action setup goes, that is very much fixed.
And that's Seven Empires by Matt Gertz.
Love Matt Gertz designs. If you haven't tried Antica or Imperial, either Antica or Antica 2, or either Imperial or Imperial 2030, highest possible recommendation. I get to play A Gentle Rain. One of the things I like to do on the road is visit game stores, and I visited a couple of very, very nice game stores in Jersey and Philadelphia, and I picked up in New Jersey A Gentle Rain. So this is by Kevin Wilson, published by Incredible Dreams Studios last year. This is indeed the same Kevin Wilson that designed Descent and Arkham Horror and all those fantasy flight games of the early aughts, and now he has designed A Gentle Rain, which is a very minimalist tile-laying solo game. The rulebook recommends that you take a deep breath. You stand up, you roll your shoulders back, get the tension out. Maybe relax with a nice drink.
Gentle Rain.
No, I mean it. And I did all these things because I was trying to see if it was more than a tile-laying puzzle, right? Because sometimes, you know, if you assume that you know better than the game designer or the game presentation, which, quite frankly, is both an occupational hazard and a character flaw I have, you might miss out on a truly elevated experience, right? I'm sure there are people who play Meltwater and just push the units around and treat it like any other game. I'm sure there are individuals who don't get anything out of narrative games, and I'm not even looking down on that. I'm just saying that I've derived a significant amount of value from sometimes those games emerging, or the mood, the vibe, the narrative, the emergent values.
Like, if you don't welcome someone to Naviri, Mark, then are they really experiencing Naviri?
Forgot about how you always did that. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, so meeting, wanting to meet A Gentle Rain on its own terms, I did all those things. Prepared myself a nice, cool beverage on a hot day, rolled my shoulder. Anyway, it was an okay tiling puzzle. What can I say? It is a game where the square tiles have one of different colored flowers on each edge. You play them out in a grid, and you have to match edge to edge. And the goal is to make 2x2 squares. You do that. I'm leaving out a fair number of rules. there's more to it than that. I found some of the puzzle elements interesting, frankly. There were some trade-offs to be done. There was a relatively simple strategic insight that I realized, which is, given that all tiles have four different colors around them, if you ever set up a corner situation with two of the same color, you'll never be able to place there because no tile has two colors of the same type on two different sides. Anyway, this is the level of insight that I'm capable of when it comes to positional abstracts. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was okay. It was a cute little thing. It's a very, very tiny box. It was very appropriate as a souvenir. It was interesting to see such a design from Kevin Wilson. I may play it again. It's very short, very approachable, rather pretty. It's got embossing on both sides of the tiles. It's well done. It doesn't quite hit the mood. Like, it's a relatively thinky abstract puzzle. It's a strange kind of vibe. It's kind of like a little bit what I would call the Calico effect, you know, leveraging cute kitties and at the same time burning your brain into mush. It's not quite to that level. But the whole sort of, this is just a gentle, we're having a little gentle lark here. Gentle just relax. Here, solve this puzzle. Figure out this puzzle. Oh, you placed it in the wrong way. You're stuck forever now. You're not smart. Relax. Relax, dummy.
Yeah, I was gonna say the same thing. Good job, idiot.
Deep breath, moron.
Deep breath.
So that's A Gentle Rain by Kevin Wilson and Incredible Dream Studios.
Quick note on Flip 7. It is now on Board Game Arena. This is designed by...
Is Flip 7 on Board Game Arena?
Yeah, but I'm saying this because, well, it's this designed by Eric Olson and put out by OP Games.
For those, so you can play an asynchronous game of Flip 7 over 7 years.
Oh, no, you never do that. This is... I'm only bringing this up because some people sort of like mill or grind to try to get to their...
Oh,
right?
Okay.
And so this has replaced what I usually would do. You know, over on the side, I'd have merchandise going or can't stop, right?
Okay, sure.
Now it's Flip 7. And it's a lot even...
You just keep busting
all
the time.
Yeah, it's even easier. And now all you have to do is like either hit or stay, and off you go.
Sure.
And so Flip 7, Board Game Arena, for those that are trying to get to their, you know, games played so they can start playtesting the alpha games, it's a great addition.
That leads naturally into the next solo game that I played this week, which is Number 9. Now, it's not really Number 9. It's Number. There are no vowels.
No vowels.
It's been decided in marketing terms. I couldn't help but notice that when it comes to water, maybe this is just American water brands. There's a whole bunch of different kinds of brands of water where there's some modifier for the water, and then water and the modifier word don't have any vowels in them.
Do you know
so
that really,
water
I was going to say, do you know how that really helps for someone who wants to buy it and look it up on Board Game Geek? You know, changing the word number really helps them find it anywhere.
So Number 9 is a tiling game. It's basically multiplayer solitaire if you play multiplayer anyway. It's one of those puzzle type games where the order of the tiles you'll be placing is randomized, but everyone follows the same order. So the tile 1 is roughly shaped like a 1. The tile 2 is roughly shaped like a 2. And so forth. It's just 0 to 9. And you're just placing tiles. The goal is to place tiles as high as you possibly can, but you cannot stack a tile on top of a tile if it leaves any overhang or any empty space, and you cannot stack a tile on top of a single tile. It has to cross at least 2 tiles. So what you want to do is make a base that is as narrow as possible and climb as high as possible, because your score is the number of the tile times its level, where anything that touches the table is level 0. So in order to score anything, you need to get off the base level of the table. It was fine. It's the same tiles every time. They have the same little bits of connector that are going to be tricky every time. And so it didn't really seem like it was maximally leveraging the clever component of the clever conceit. My understanding is that there is an expandalone version called Number 9 Plus Plus. Apparently they've discovered vowels in time for the plus, although it's the mathematical symbol, so I don't know. They have little gap fillers or special powers or weird things that change things up, make it a little less solvable, a little less repetitive. That I might be more interested in. As it is, I thought it was a relatively cool conceit with respect to the tiles, but it didn't seem to have much legs. And so that is Number 9, designed by Peter Vickman, originally published by Abacus Spiel in 2017.
I finally got Earthborn Rangers back to the table. This is designed by Andrew Fisher, Brooks Fugar-Levitt, Andrew Navarro, Adam Sadler, and Bradley Sadler, and published by Earthborn Games. It is sort of a adventurous deck-building type game, narrative. You're looking at books or reading, you know, paragraphs in the book. It took so long because I know someone's going to say, well, Mike, just go to this page and I'll tell you how to do it. There was no sort of, here's how you reset Earthborn Rangers. Mark and I had played it, and I knew some of the cards were in where they weren't supposed to be. And so I said, you know, is there a way? And no matter how I looked it up, there was no sort of easy way to reset. So a lot of times I would read the rules and try to get it out, and then we just choose something else to play. This time I just went through how to play, and it was like, okay, well, now you take this card from this number of X cards. So it was very nice that way. Like when you went through how to start a game, it would tell you how many cards you were supposed to have. So I could just say, oh, okay, well, pull out here these cards. Now that's set back to the way it's supposed to be. Got it all going again.
Oh, so rather than instructions to reset, you just followed the reset, the instructions to begin a new game.
Exactly.
And that effectively got you where you needed to go. Fair enough.
Just so. And so Huey and I have started a new campaign. So whenever we play together, we'll start doing that, and so more to come. So Earthborn Rangers, I'm not sure how future games will go, because I feel as though sort of creating your character is very interesting.
I think future games are going to be with robots.
With robots. And so there's a prelude mission, Mark, and it walks you through very slowly. Like if you go back, if you're a veteran of Earthborn Rangers, you make your deck and you start off on your campaign. But there is a prelude that baby steps you through every step of the way. Now, unfortunately, at one point, you know, and literally every step of the way, and at one point, it goes, now play through a whole turn that you'll find on page 12. And it doesn't baby step you through that.
Yeah.
And so now, and I didn't realize that. I said, oh, look, there's a prelude, and we'll get to baby step that. So instead of reading the rule book for the third time, we'll just go through that, and then it'll teach us. And then we get to that point, and we're like, oh, so how does, because there's like a middle section and the far away section and the close to you section, and figuring out how all that worked, we had to now, you know, slowly go through the rule book, which was a pain, which is unfortunate. If you're going to have like a walkthrough, then have a walkthrough. Just tell us what cards to put out. Show us how things work, because you've done that the whole way already. Why stop now? Anyway, Earthborn Rangers, you are a ranger. You know, you've graduated and now you're off on your mission and you need to get successes. Another game of successes. It's like
every game I play is a game of successes.
Exactly. So you have things that are close to you, and usually the sort of to advance the round is in the middle. And in order to engage the middle, you're going to get fatigued if you don't clean up your area. So you can either clean up your area or you can fatigue yourself to advance the middle part. And so you are trying to divert deer so far, deer or foxes, or you're trying to kill deer or foxes. You know, your choice. You know,
six of one.
Play your bliss. And then, you know, you try to put tokens on the middle part so you can travel to a new area, read some text. I think it's going to be interesting. Some of the way the cards interact with each other. The story is not terrible. Like I said, I've only played the first missions twice now. More to come on Earthborn Rangers.
Sometimes, Walker, there's a game, regardless of your opinions of it as an actual game product or your opinions of playing the game, you hate the game. This is very much true for me in Everdell. First off, let's talk about Everdell as a game. Everdell as a game is a relatively straightforward worker placement tableau building game where you recruit these very charming critters and these very charming critter buildings. And it does have one element which is potentially clever, whereby if you have a building out, it allows you to play out a specific critter for free. Now, in practice, I don't actually like how that shakes out, because the card flow is relatively stagnant. And so even if you want to try to mill through the deck as quickly as possible, to try to find these bonus combinations, or to find the combinations that are the prerequisites for the high point scoring missions or events, your hand limit is a very constant pressure, and there's not a whole lot of great ways to cycle through the deck quickly in order to do that. There are some things you can do, absolutely. There's this place called the Haven, where for every two cards you ditch, you can get a resource of your choice. Absolutely, that's one way to do it. But overall, the card flow of Everdell, I think, is insufficient to leverage those potentially interesting points. And so what comes off is a relatively functional worker placement resource thing, where you're putting out cards to get points, and sometimes there are synergies with the cards, and sometimes not. Whatever, it's all fine.
Aggressively mediocre.
Then there's a whole lot of other things about Everdell that I detest. So one of the things that is really obnoxious is that it's got this lovely tree that holds some of the elements of the game, specifically the missions and the workers that you get access to in future. But what this means is you cannot sit in a normal way that any... Now, sometimes if you've got a long table, you could put it at the head, and then everyone can interact with the tree, I guess. But we were at a circular table, and the moment we sat down at the circular table, oh, no. Because this was this is a term I was introduced to. This was a push present. Push presents are not what we would call pro-social behavior, but they happen.
Push it into the recycling bin.
Well, no. No, a push present is a gift that is given to somebody with the hopes that it will cause them to do something. In this particular case, look, we've all been there. I tried very hard to evolve out of the stage of my hobby life of, oh, I'll just give games as gift for people. That way they'll play games with me. It's understandable. I don't mean to condemn people that do it, but don't do it. Just don't do it. Anyway, as a service, therefore, I volunteered to teach this game to our hosts in New Jersey that had been subjected to it and asserted that they didn't have the time or mental bandwidth to learn how to play a game. I can understand that. I do this for a living. It's okay. I decided to throw myself on that particular grenade. But then when we sat down at a circular table, oh, crap. So there's that issue. And then there's the issue. This is entirely... This makes me so angry. Everdell wasn't necessarily the first, but it was definitely at the cutting edge of, hey, you won the game. Take this card and upload a selfie of you in social media to celebrate that you've won. I do not like it when companies of any type, be they game companies or anything else, try to make me a prop in their social media campaign. I'm sorry. I find it super obnoxious. So, Everdell is a perfectly functional, mediocre game that has some cute artwork, some obnoxious component choices, and an unfortunate emphasis on social media. So, all told, my dissatisfaction and disgust of Everdell is perhaps exaggerated, but I can assure you, it is sincere. So, that was my somewhat reluctant experience with Everdell.
Lastly from me, I got a couple plays of Shackleton Base, A Journey to the Moon. This is finally available in North America. This is published by Pandasaurus Games and designed by Fabio Lupiano and Nestore Mangione. And when I was playing it and reading the rulebook, I was just constantly reminded of a game called Ceres, put out by Artipia Games. Not because it's, you know, in no way, you know, a riff on it or anything like that. It just has some very similar design elements. Like in Ceres and Shackleton Base, they've grouped the actions you can do with your workers into these areas and then given them a symbol saying you can do it if this card for combo reasons, right? You play this card, you get to do one of these actions, which is in this category. And they've also, and it's also based on ships showing up with different colored workers that will do different things. So all these things sort of correlated together. Just
yeah, those
made
are
them very similar. I could
very
do,
similar to Ceres,
I could
yeah.
do one of my things where I explain the game and it could mean either one. Right. Anyway.
Right.
Moving on. There are 7 different corporations that come with Shackleton Base, and you're only going to use a subset of 3 of them. And so both times I explain the game by just explaining the base game. Here's the 3 groups of actions that there are you're going to do on your turn. This is what they do. And it seems to work out that way because there's only one action that's going to let you interact with the corporations. And believe it or not, Mark, it's called the corporation action.
Slow down.
I know. And so the corporation action is going to let you do all the things. So there's one that's the baby's first Shackleton, Mark, which I should have, the very first time I played it,
it's important to emphasize the last syllable there. Baby's first Shackleton.
Yes.
Gotta get through it. You don't want to swallow that tongue.
No, no. So I should have played with baby's first corporations both times. But the first time I played it, someone had played it before and they already played with those ones. So we played with 3 different ones.
It was Warm Boy, wasn't it?
It was.
It was Warm Boy.
Warm Boy.
Warm Boy.
Ruined the game.
The yep.
This
yep.
is why I had to play it the second time because I wanted to have fun.
Sure.
Anyway, so the difficulty ratings were a little bit higher than the ones we did. And I think it was not only confusing to me, it was confusing to the other players. It was like the game is putting buildings on in the Shackleton crater, but one was a trip to Mars. So you're actually like lifting up your buildings, and they're getting teleported to Mars. And
okay.
So anyway, the baby first Shacklin base modules are, one is a tourist. You're getting tourists and you're putting them in your base, and then you're populating the cards that you get to buy. Each corporation is its own board where you're, you know, buying stuff from there and getting cards that will help you interact with that particular corporation. The base game is putting out buildings into the crater because that's the way you're going to get resources that will help you do the rest of the things of the game, because one of the actions is to put one of your astronauts around the rim of the crater. And then you go down that line and you have to activate all of the hexes on that line, and you, depending on the color of the worker, either you're getting all the corporation stuff or you're getting resources or you're getting money. And so you want to have lots of presence down these lines, because if you don't have presence in a certain hex, you have to pay the person that does. And at the end of every round, all of those astronauts that you put around the crater are going to go to people, whoever has the highest influence in that particular line.
Oh, I see.
So lots of interesting things going on there. Lots of interesting things going on in the game. I really enjoyed it. It has this thing that you have to sort of explain to people. You have your workers and you have your astronauts. They're the same pieces. It's just that when you get your workers every round, sort of key flower reasons.
Oh, sure. It's
key flower ways. There's, you know, you're going to get six actions every turn because there's spaceships that show up every turn. You pick your spaceship, it has six workers on it of different colors. So those are the six workers you're going to have. You can't take those astronauts and put them right on your board. There's actions that let you interact with astronauts that are already out there, and then they're the ones that can go back to your board. Nor can you take astronauts on your board and use them for action. So you just have to make sure you tell people these are two separate things and they don't directly interact.
Sure.
You have to sort of go through hoops. And there's all sorts of benefits you get on your board for putting these workers in certain places. Anyway, I very much enjoyed Shacklin Base.
I had completely forgotten that it's designed by Fabio Lopiano and Astoria Mangione. I mean, they're the duo who created Autobahn, which was my surprise delight of that year. And I'd been hearing you talk about Shackleton Base for a while, mostly waiting for it to arrive. But I dissociated that it was done by them.
So I'm hoping that I can show this to you next week, and then I'm eager to hear what you think.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to trying it. It sounds like it's got some interesting combinations of Euro mechanisms that we've enjoyed elsewhere, which, you know, That may sound like damning with faint praise, but that often produces very good results.
Yeah, it seemed to be enjoyed by everyone. It was a lot for everyone, but we got through it. That is Shackleton Base.
This time we can make sure to play with that warm boy.
Yes.
Yeah. Finally for me, the same couple that prompted my play of Everdell made the comment that it is very difficult with young children to find time to play games. And specifically the lament was, well, you know, there are lots of good games for children, but it can be difficult to find a game that is compelling for someone who is very early on in grade school, but also good for adults. And I said, well, have you tried dexterity games? This is my unique calling. This is one of the reasons why I love dexterity games, because they are flexible for all age player counts. So long as you've got adults that are interested in playing with toys, dexterity games can be your bag. And they said, no, we haven't tried dexterity games. I'd noticed that they had a Haba game on their shelf. The bright yellow box is very difficult to mistake. And I said, well, I can recommend Animal Upon Animal. And sure enough, at the game store in Jersey, what was for sale at a deep discount, but Animal Upon Animal? I'm like, okay, well, this is a no-brainer. And so I taught them Animal Upon Animal. I love Animal Upon Animal. It's delightful. Is it balanced? Haha, pun? No, it's not. Because your goal is to get rid of pieces, and on your turn, you roll a die, and the die might tell you to place one piece or place two pieces. And it might tell you to have to place the piece on the towering mound of animals that you're making out of delightful wooden pieces, or just put it on the table at the top end or the back end. Eh, so fine, whatever. It's okay. I'm not the competitive uber nerd or incredibly competitive individual that the internet makes me out to be. I am more than happy to just play around with cute little wooden penguins and monkeys and toucans and guild lizards and such. Was it a hit with the children? Yes. Was it a hit with the PhD professors that we played with? I don't know. I didn't ask. I don't care. I had a good time. And sure enough, I know how to play games with children. They knock over a piece when it's not their turn. You just put the piece back in the box. You don't care. It's fine. Move on. I am told, and this is something I've been meaning to try for years now, that the Animal Upon Animal balancing bridge version is truly the ideal intersection of hobbyist experience and child-friendly experience. So I've been very curious to try Balancing Bridge. It is out of print. I haven't been able to find it anywhere. But like I say, I am perfectly happy with Animal Upon Animal. I think it's delightful. It is probably my favorite game for very young children. A little bit older, I will then start trying to introduce them to things like Rhino Heroes Super Battle or perhaps other dexterity
Micro
games.
Micro Macro.
Micro Macro, absolutely. Micro Macro is good for lots of different children, but for toy factor, for just the anyone will be, well, no patience required, really. They can even go off and run around and do their little goblin children activities in between turns or whatever. So long as they're able, as they're old enough to understand what it is to take turns and play in sequence, which admittedly is a high social barrier. I'm not. It's a difficult lift. I'm not going to say it's trivial, but once you're past that level, you're good. And I have yet to meet the serious gamer that looks down their nose at Animal Upon Animal. I'm sure they exist. In fact, I'm sure we play games with them, frankly. I just really like Animal Upon Animal. It's delightful.
I like it because it's not like the more recent children's games where everyone wins, everyone, you know, is having a great time. There is, like, sort of take that. There is, you know, giving pieces to other players.
True.
Not that it's mean or anything, but it introduces it slowly.
You had me with... It's not one of those children's games where everyone wins. I'm like, okay, well, we love cooperative games, but whatever. And they're like, it's not one of those games where everyone's having a good time. I'm like, wait, slow down.
I just mean it's not like, everyone's on equal footing. Everyone wins. No one's against me. There's actually like sort of, I'm sure. Giving you some of my pieces. I'm forcing you to play a certain piece. There's,
sure.
It's introducing competitiveness in not, a super harsh way.
Wow. I'm getting an insight into the way you have raised your children. And I am now very concerned.
I mean, it's not like a direct sort of take. I'm doing this to advance. You know what I mean? It's
a light sort of.
Anyway.
That is Animal Upon Animal. There are very many number of editions and different versions. As I say, I really want to try the Balancing Bridge version. But I've had I think I've only tried a couple other versions, but they've all been very, very nice. You know, delightful manufacturer, lovely little gamification of fun shapes. Animal Upon Animal. Those are the games we played last week. We're now going to take a brief break to pay some bills.
Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's managed hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta. Simply better hosting.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And we're back, and now we're into the news and why it doesn't matter.
Here comes SwagCon, Mark. It's marched even 1 week closer.
Really? Over the course of the past week, it's gotten a week closer?
It has. It's so weird.
It's relentless.
Yes.
Do you know how many spots we have left, Walker?
How many spots do we have left, Mark?
12. We have 12 spots left as of this morning. So we're going to have a great turnout, as it is. And if you want your tickets, again, I don't want to create an atmosphere of scarcity. Yeah. I'm just letting you know that, we have a venue.
Yeah.
And there's
If you're waiting,
now might be the time.
Yeah.
There is a link to be able to purchase tickets to SwagCon, a.k.a. Congrès Souverain About Games. Fun times, good vibes only, trans rights or human rights board game jamboree. And by the way, I know this is not the core remit of this podcast, but it deserves repeating. It's been another bad week for trans rights. There are a number of governments out there that seem to hate you. But we here at SWAG, we see you. We love you. We love that you're part of the board game community. We want you at SwagCon. We love you even when your government doesn't. It's despicable. I'm disgusted. Anyway, July 25th, 26th, and 27th at Kingston, Ontario. We would love to see you there.
Getting ready, Mark. Be aware.
Getting ready? Getting pumped?
Be aware that if you're attending SwagCon, you'll get free games.
Yes.
Mandatory.
At least one. We will beg you to take more.
And so I'm getting prepared. The boxes are forming up.
Yep.
And
I have yet to do the great division of my of the collection, but
And my plan right now is I'm going to make three piles of four games. And these are the four games that I'm going to bring each day. And I'm going to make sure I know the rules for those four games and be able to teach them. And then that'll be set. And there'll be no pressure about bringing, you know, this giant thing.
Sure.
And being ready. These are the four games I'm going to play. And then if I get those done, then I can go out and play games that other people have brought.
I am, for what it's worth, just as a note, I'm going to be talking more about this in bonus episodes to come. But my primary focus is just going to be on being available. Four games, yes, but also just for the listeners, anyone who wants to talk and tell me about how wrong I am about the pa-pa-pa-pa and all the other ways in which I'm clearly deficient in my opinions, which is fine. That's part of the...
How you don't know how to play Ankh and you don't know how it works yet?
No. Games I like, nobody accuses you of not knowing how to play. It's the games you don't like that they accuse you of not knowing how to play.
Yeah, true.
On the topic of bonus episodes, this is an episode which is multiple of five, so we will talk about the Patreon, which say we have a Patreon, ad-free episodes, access to the Discord, access to exclusive content. We're going to be having at least two, Walker, count them, two. That is twice as many bonus episodes this week alone. We're going to be doing some bloat. We're going to be doing some Pledge of Indifference that was briefly delayed. So look forward to that, as well as access to the literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of past bonus episodes. If you want to support free and independent media, we'd appreciate that. If you don't, that's cool too. Patreon.com/swag. Finally, the province of my birth, Quebec, which is a marvelous place. If I had my druthers, I would retire to Montreal if I were unburdened by family obligations. That is absolutely where I would be. That having been said, ma patrimoine, the place of my birth, has done some truly terrible things over the course of its history. It has been brought up on human rights abuses by the UN, and specifically the gaming hook now is Law 96. Law 96 has a number of provisions, among them certain requirements that certain products be translated into French at certain times. What does this mean? This possibly means the end of Warhammer in Quebec as we know it, because Games Workshop products are not appropriately labeled. There's been a number of news segments of people talking to hobby game store owners, hobbyists in general, and the delightful community of minis game players in particular are going to be very badly affected. Board gaming as well is going to be very negatively affected, but that there are more products available that have been translated there, so at least there'll be some possibility. Role players will be fine because books are exempted, because they are cultural. Games, on the other hand, bit of a problem. There is a link in the episode notes below to some news coverage of this you will also see. And frankly, when I see things like this, it delights my Francophonie heart. It shows some people playing Warhammer in French, interspersing their fluent French with some English terms. When I see this, I see my culture. When other people see this, they get paranoid and they seek to restrict people's freedom. Thus endeth Mark's political soapbox for today. That is the news and why it doesn't matter. We're now going to move on to our topic, which is small box, big game.
So this means nice little boxes.
Very nice little boxes. Very nice little pequeño boxes.
And you think it's just going to be this light, it's like a card game or something.
It's like a tiny little filler.
And we'll be done in 20 minutes, it'll be fine. But no, look, it sprawls all over the table. Sometimes, not every time. And there's in-depth, there's multiple actions, there's choices, lots of things to do.
Which is not to say, by the way, just to be clear, we are not crapping over fillers.
No.
Those games that are small card games that are 20 minutes long, you know, your Scouts, your Flip Sevenses, your whatever, we love those too. Absolutely. But there's something about the game that looks like it's going to be your Oink game, or it's going to be or even some of the Oink games, frankly. Those tiny little boxes, and so you think it's just a deck of cards and it's going to be 20 minutes. And you get this, it's hard to describe, it's a frisson of delight. It's like a Marie Kondo kind of lizard brain appreciation. I'm connecting together a whole bunch of different things together. Of having such a big experience in a tiny box. I don't know if people who don't have storage issues have this. I don't know if people who are unconcerned by environmental issues have this, but I can definitely tell you that as somebody who grapples with both of those, I value it a great deal. But there's just something inherently pleasing to me about the full big box experience in a tiny little package. It's delightful.
Yeah, because more on the way you said, why is this a good thing? Because like you said, it's easier to transport. Say if how you game is going out to either other people's houses or a gaming night, and you can only add so many games to your bag, having them in smaller boxes is just better.
Absolutely.
The other thing I think works is intimidation. when you bring out this giant box and you plant it on the table, or people that are just used to light games or smaller games,
that's so true.
They see you this giant, they're just right off, put by
it,
right?
We've talked about this before. It is a miraculous, not in a good way, phenomenon whereby sometimes, for whatever reason, in response to whatever stimulus, people just shut down and convince themselves they can't understand something. And sometimes you're right. It's just the box. You bring it. It's like, oh, I don't know. That looks like a long... No. It's a huge box, but it's really, really short. It's like, oh, that looks very intimidating. It's like, no, it's just a super simple thing in a big box, which is sometimes also pleasant, but also burdensome.
So now you have this little box. They're not so scared, and they bring you... You get a chance to get to bring them in.
It's true. So we're on the same page. We're not going to be talking about fillers here.
That's correct.
Even really good ones. Again, there are some brilliant fillers out there. For Sale, I will go to the mat defending For Sale. Fairy Tale, brilliant game. But that's not necessarily the vibe that we're going for here.
And the other thing I think
we might fight on a couple of designs, though.
Oh, I'm sure.
We'll see.
The other thing I want to say is that, let's be real, I was trying to put a percentage on it. I think it's high. Say 70% of games can be in a smaller box already.
Smaller, absolutely.
Yeah.
70 may be a conservative estimate as far as smaller, but yeah.
All right. So what I got left is just a large list of games.
Okay. Can we talk first a little bit about some of the categories?
We sure can.
Because there's a category game that I think it's kind of on the cusp. Because again, we don't really want to talk about fillers, but especially with the recent boom, I would like to have a little bit of discussion about trick takers in general.
Yes, all right? I did tend to leave them off.
Yeah, so some of them, it's weird. And this is very vibey, and I'd be very interested to hear your vibes. I have two examples of trick takers that I think might kind of belong on the list, and a couple of examples that might kind of not. The ones that I think kind of sort of belong in the sort of big game experience in a small package are Sale, which is another game that I got to play this week. Set it up in a board game cafe in Philadelphia, and I think it was called The Game Keeper was the name of the title of the individual. They said, oh, great game. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know. And the other is the Crew games. Those, to me, feel like full, big boxy kind of things, even though the Crew is just cards. But the Sale as well, it's like a tiny little board, very, very efficient use of little tokens.
And I do want to throw Fishing in there, the new Freedom Freeze one, right? Because you'd go through a series of games, right? So it's like sort of a full experience as well.
I guess I could see that. But for whatever reason, something like the Marshmallow Test, which we both love, but it just feels like, yeah, it's a trick-taking game. It's quote-unquote, just a card game.
Yeah, or Scout, yes.
Or Scout, like yeah. Well, Scout being a climbing game, but same difference. Yeah. Yeah, and so I don't know what it is. Sometimes it's components, because Sale, I think, gets by largely on basis of components. There's a full board, there's tokens to lay out the board, and et cetera, and the card play drives stuff that's going on the board. The Crew, I don't know, it's just a card game, but for whatever reason, it feels like more of a whole thing. I don't know.
Yeah, and there's
maybe this is me talking about how much I like the Crew.
There's other games that I left out only for me. I know you probably have some of them on here. I left them out only because they are made specifically to be small. Like, so all the Button Shy games and Buttons and Bugs, I just left off of this list because they're just specifically made to fit and be small. Look, I'm just saying this is just, I just left them off.
I'm not ready to fight you, Walker. I'm not going to dive over the table and tackle you.
Well, then why are you lifting a club? Like, I don't understand. You say you're not.
Because the club is long enough so I don't have to go over the table. It makes perfect sense. So, I don't know. What do you mean by it was made? Because I think Button Shy games absolutely belong on this kind of list.
I'm not saying they don't belong.
Oh, okay.
They 100% belong on the list. Okay. I'm just saying I left those particular ones off only because they go into a category of designed specifically to only be 18 cards or whatever. They are designed to be small, whereas some the other games I have are just regular games.
I have a particular appreciation, though. I talked before about the works of Joe Klipfel and, you know, Behold Rome and Buttons and Bugs that he co-designed with Dickie Valens. I get a lot of delight out of that tiny little box for Gloomhaven, Buttons and Bugs.
Like I said, they 100% belong here.
Okay.
I just knew that you were going to cover them.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
And so to reduce my list down a bit smaller, I left those ones.
Okay, then let me get. I've already given my eulogy for Joe Klipfel several times. I've eulogized him rather than given a eulogy. Given a eulogy necessarily, I think, implies that he's dead. But eulogized the work of, I think, doesn't imply it quite so strongly. Anyway, setting it aside, I would like to eulogize Button Shy for a little bit because I think Button Shy, I wish I had more experience with more of their games. Button Shy games are not particularly easy to get your hands on in Canada, and they release so many designs. I'm confident that a lot of them are not worth my time. But by the same token, I've had some experiences with Buttonshy games that are really cool, like Sprawlopolis.
They're mostly cards, not many tokens, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for that, Walker.
Okay.
So Sprawlopolis does a lot of work with a small number of cards. Like, efficiency is at the core of a lot of what we're talking about here. And I love Battlecrest. We've played Battlecrest a couple times. It is a super impressive, interesting design that is very efficient in terms of cards. They've also got this line of games by Peter Hayward called Converge. Peter Hayward is the guy who designed both Things in Rings and That Time You Killed Me, which is an interesting set of design pedigree. Anyway, just all the time I see announcements about what Buttonshy is up to, and I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. It's like, oh yeah, they're hard to get in Canada. So I derive a tremendous amount of delight. Now, that having been said, Buttonshy games really lean in, I think, to two of the problems with some of these smaller box games, and then we'll start talking about specific designs we like. I understand completely, from a marketing perspective, why big boxes are more popular. They take up lots of shelf space, they attract the eye of the consumer, they're easier to sell. This is what I've been told by a number of different people.
That, and there is a definite problem, right? We have it here where...
That's exactly what I was about to get to.
Oh,
yes.
Sorry, yep. Go ahead.
No, go on.
Where, like, we even have this here where I've got some shelves around our gaming table. And so we say, okay, well, what do we want to play? And so we look on the shelves,
yep,
and we see the big boxes.
Yep.
Not that it's the fact that, one, they're small, so you don't see them. And two, they're usually three deep.
Yes.
So you don't see the ones that are in the back.
Not only are they harder to stock, they're harder to shelve, whether it's in the context of a store or of an individual hobbyist. And therefore, it is so easy to forget about them. And so I understand why there's this drive for two big boxes. It's tragic, really. Like, the Buttonshy games are especially vulnerable to this. You can sell them pretty easily. In fact, you know, it's a great sort of next to the cash impulse buy to sort of set up. I saw some Buttonshy games for sale recently in a special display stand right next to the cash. That was great. But the thing is, the Buttonshy games that I have, sometimes I even forget where they are on the shelves because they're just these tiny little plastic wallets. And they stack up so cleanly and neatly, and I'm so pleased when I do that, and then I forget where they are. And it's a problem. I don't know if there's a solution to it, but anyway. So yeah, I do like Buttonshy as a company. I find them super interesting. So let's talk about some specific designs. What do you got, Walker?
I've got Land, Air, and Sea, Mark.
Do you now?
I do.
Huh.
It is, both players have roughly the same deck, and you're playing cards, and you're just sort of trying to figure out what cards they have, and you're putting out lanes. It's been so long since I played it. I remember it being a fairly full experience in a nice little box.
It is, but it's like a two-player head-to-head quick card game.
You think it would be more in the filler? That's fine. I'm not going to...
So it's weird. It's not... Now we're just playing with definitions. It's just... When I play Land, Air, and Sea... Is it Land... I always get the order wrong. Is it Air, Land, and Sea?
It could be wrong. I didn't copy and paste that one.
Because there's Heroes of Land, Air, and Sea, which we do not enjoy at all.
Yes. And it's definitely not a small box.
No, it's Air, Land, and Sea.
That's what I said.
Okay, good. Thank you. So, Air, Land, and Sea is, I think, an incredible design. But I don't think it rises above its fundamentally small box status. Like, when I think of a lot of the works of...
Let's put Regicide in there, because that's my next one. I would say that in sort of complexity and size of box and what they bring to the table, I think they're relatively similar.
I disagree. Okay. I would put... Here's the thing.
I think this is a good example of why one would be higher than the other.
Well, higher.
You know what I mean. Fitting to our subject.
I think I'm a huge fan of the works of John Perry. All right? And I think... And Air, Land, and Sea was the first game of his that we tried. And we've loved pretty much everything that he's put out that we've tried from him. Right? But Time Barons, Air, Land, and Sea, probably even Spots... Probably even Scapegoat, like everything short of Hot Streak. Hot Streak is not a small box game anymore. It's already started, and it's a glorious. What it does with the box is glorious. Don't get me wrong, but they feel like small box games to me. They feel like they're operating within that idiom, and that's one of the reasons why I half jokingly call him the king of the small box. When I play Air, Land, and Sea, I'm like, that was great, super tense, super well done, super efficient use of time. But I don't think it aspires to or achieves anything like greater. It's not like trying to go outside the strictures of its format. Whereas when I look at some of these 18 card designs, when I look at other things like Regicide, does things with a deck of cards that I wouldn't have thought possible. A number of button shy designs do things with 18 cards that I wouldn't have thought possible. Buttons and Bugs does like gets you a full tactical combat experience in a tiny, very, very, very tiny setup. Whereas two-player Card Battler, this discussion here is one big vibe check, and I'm trying to give form to my vibe, and I realize therefore that can be difficult. But nonetheless, here's where we are.
No, I can see that.
Let there be no mistake. I adore the games of John Perry, and how dare you make me try to minimize? Now I feel dirty. How dare you, Walker?
I'm a bad man.
You are a bad man. No, Regicide, I think, is a good example of what I get. It's like, this is like a full co-op game. It scales well. It's got an arc to it. It breathes. There's interesting. Yeah. I think Regicide is a good example of this.
I'm sure you're going to win soon, Mark. I really do.
Someday, Walker. Eventually, it must happen. What else you got?
I have Divir games, a lot of them.
Yep, a lot of Divir games.
Because, man, do they...
Yeah, it's very... Their aesthetic, their idiom, most of the time, sometimes they'll put something out in a full box. And a lot of the time, they're just distributing or republishing something that somebody else did. But Sand, the Red Cathedral, just super minimalist boxes.
White Castle,
unsurprisingly.
Three Ring Circus.
Oh, I forgot they did Three Ring Circus, too. Yeah. Yeah, super impressive, super satisfying, difficult to repack, almost impossible to have the expansion material work, but worth it. It's just so delightful. It's like, here's this full medium weight Euro in a box that's smaller than a lot of other fillers that are just a deck of cards. It's wonderful. And you never feel, once you set these games up, you know, the boards aren't huge. I'm not going to say that they're table-covering monsters. But at no point when playing a lot of these Devir games that we've talked about have I ever thought, this is a little smaller than I'd like. Or, these materials are a little chibi.
Yeah, it's so small I can't read the iconography. You know
precisely.
What I mean? Yeah.
Whereas Oink Games has done some very, very impressive packaging to get them all fixed in that box. But it's always usually pretty small. Like if you think about Undersea Adventure or things of that nature, the components are itty-bitty. I have affection for that too. But again, it seems more solidly in the small box idiom than a big game in a small box.
Next up, I have Gnar, which we both love.
Yeah, I suspected that we would also have a bit of a vibe check for Gnar. Gnar, to me, is a very good filler. And it is nothing more.
Okay, it's definitely pushing that boundaries of filler.
Yes, I'll grant you that much. But here's the thing. When it comes to the pacing of Gnar, when it comes to how much you're going to get done in terms of whether or not there's an ebb and flow, there isn't really too much. Generally speaking, you're going to make one or two big purchases and the rest is fiddling around the margins. It's really good. And I enjoy it, but it feels to me like a very good small box filler. If I'm going to compare Gnar to even something like Sail or even Regicide or anything by Devir, I think it's on another side of that divide. I can completely respect if it's not for you, and I think that you enjoy Gnar more than I do, but I really like Gnar. So that's where I'm sitting.
So we played a lot of Rumble Nation recently, and Rumble Nation is in a very small box.
It's a lot bigger than a lot of the Devir Games boxes, sure. It's pretty efficient. And I also don't know... Yeah, it's weird. It's lighter. If anything, it's lighter than Gnar is, right? And the box is bigger. So so it's weird. It's verging. Yeah, I don't know where I'd put Rumble Nation. And I've only seen the one edition. There have been other editions as well. You could make Rumble Nation in a truly tiny box. Yes. You could make a good edition of Rumble Nation, possibly even in an Oink game style box.
I think so.
Or even slightly bigger. There, I think I'd have no problem adapting it into the big game small box moniker. As it is, I think it might be pushing it both in terms of dimensions and quantity of game involved.
Next up, I have General Orders World War II. It's the David Thompson game.
Oh, yeah.
It's a two-player head-to-head.
Yeah, I think that's
big
a
big game.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. I think that just because it's two player, you don't get disqualified, right? But I agree with you. The general orders has enough going on. There's this card play element. There's the different maps. There's a whole bunch of stuff. Yeah, it feels substantial. I'm interested to see how they develop the system. And of course, it's worth mentioning it's co-designed by David Thompson and Trevor Benjamin, if for no other reason than the CanCon.
This one is not really. It's a smaller box than most, Mark.
All right,
but it is the amount of game that is in this size of box.
Okay, we're pushing it.
This
Talk
is
to
Food
me.
Chain Magnet.
No, right, that right, doesn't belong here. No, look. If we wanted to broaden the discussion to impressive amount of density of game, well then yeah, sure, but then at some point, like, I would argue that even MegaCiv qualifies because there's so much game in there even though the box is huge.
True,
let's
but
have a little discipline
it's,
here.
It's definitely smaller than a Ticket to Ride box.
Sure. Look. Here's what I'm suggesting. Besides, that also opens up like
every Avalon Hill bookshelf game. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's emulate Divir games and have a little bit of discipline, shall we?
All right, we will. I'll skip over Isle of Skye then as well because it's roughly the same size.
Yeah.
All right. How about Skye Team then? Is the next one up after that?
I don't know. Again, slightly bigger box. Okay, right. Let me give you my examples, all right? Because
all
this,
right.
I think, is an indication of the sort of how tight we can get. I have Innovation, not the deluxe versions, but the original version where it's just the card box. And there you get all that is Innovation. I know you're not a fan of Innovation.
No,
I respect that.
Well, I haven't played it enough. I think I need to play it more.
Yeah.
And that's just not going to happen in this atmosphere.
It's true.
So there's an edition that actually comes out in just a card box?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just the double wide card box, like the retail edition of Scout.
Okay.
More or less. It's not a tuck box, it's an actual card box, but
wow.
Yeah. And then each expansion that you decide to get is sold in a box of equivalent size and shape. It's just the editions that you've played with me have been either the deluxe version, or there's the ultimate version now, which has all the expansions. I still haven't played the ultimate version. It's a shame, but it is what it is. I'll get it to the table sooner or later. Then there's Imperium the Contention.
I have that as well.
I
have Imperium, Imperialist. I wasn't sure what it was called.
That's reasonable. I cannot blame you. A bit of tragic news about Imperium the Contention. This is a bit reading between the lines. It doesn't look like they're going to reprint it because the company, Contention Games, first they did Imperium the Contention, which was a mild success. It is critical darling, very much demanded on the secondary market, but it didn't make them a whole lot of money. And then they did Slay the Spire, which is obviously on a different scale. And they always said previously that they were going to come back and do a reprint with an expansion after Slay the Spire. But now they've got a taste of that success, Walker.
Yeah.
They got a taste of the big time. I don't know that they're
now they're up on the podium, right? They don't look down.
Yeah.
Officially,
all that they've said is, yeah, we're still super enthusiastic about Imperium the Contention. Other projects have taken priority, though. But we still, and it's like, oh, yeah, sure. You know, your intention and 92 cents will get you a Snickers bar at Dollarama. Anyway, and the last example is Dungeon Twister, the card game, which was
pretty much
all of Dungeon Twister in the card game box. So that's the kind of stuff. These are the kind of things that vibe to me. That and obviously the other things you said, like Divir games, like, ooh,
yeah.
Look, it's such a small box, but it's a full thing. It's not half of a thing. It's not part of the thing. It's a full thing.
And Set a Watch. Last one I have is Set a Watch.
If
you have just the one version, if you have just like the base game, lots there, all in one box.
Absolutely. Agreed.
And there's a game here that people will say, you know, why didn't you mention this? Because we're only mentioning good games just because it's in a small box. Doesn't mean so Biblios. And so, yeah.
That was gratuitous and I loved it. Yeah. So, I mean, again, I'm hard-pressed to explain why I find it so delightful. I mean, I can come up with reasons, portability and presentation and environmental
impact. And the surprise to some people, right? When you pull out this and
it's
like,
a contagious delight.
They're like, oh my God.
Yeah. Small blocks, big games. Love it.
Yep. Agreed.
That's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate it a great deal. You can find us on all our social medias. You can find us on our website, sowronggames.com. You can find us on Patreon. We hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.